Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, sir, may I start by joining the Right Honourable Gentleman in congratulating my two honourable friends who moved and seconded the loyal address so eloquently. My honourable friend, the member for Hall Green, is, as he said, a Birmingham man through and through, and he's devoted to the city and all that it stands for. He spoke a good deal about the enterprise of Birmingham, its business, about the cooperation between the universities and industry, about the importance of small businesses. Yes, Birmingham faces problems, and my honourable friend did not attempt to dodge them. We were very interested in his constructive approach to the problems of Handsworth and his proposals for dealing with derelict land and bringing it back into positive use. As he said, Birmingham has a great future and is now setting about trying to scoop some more firsts. I congratulate him on his speech and on his own splendid record as a Birmingham Member of Parliament. Yeah. With regard to my honourable friend, the Member for Aberdeen South, how lucky he is that Edward Pearce has appreciated his endearing diffidence. We certainly appreciate it this afternoon, though I'm convinced from his own speech that he can still very much see straight. The transformation of the far north of Scotland, to which he referred, into a world centre for the offshore oil industry, is one of the great technological advances of the post-war period, as he said, and it has made the far north one of the most prosperous parts of our country by using and embracing change. That prosperity has been won at no little risk to the oil man, as we saw in the dangers that were described yesterday. I also congratulate him on his speech and the effective way that he represents his constituents. Mr. Speaker, this afternoon we heard the Right Honourable Gentleman's views on the gracious speech. But whatever the problems we have, he certainly has no solutions for them. I notice he said that our economy was shrinking. The fact is, Mr. Speaker, our production is at an all-time high, and so is investment at an all-time high. I notice that he referred to a speech made by my Right Honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Energy. I also refer to that most excellent speech when my Right Honourable friend said, "We need to win the next general election because the alternative would create the most dangerous decade this century." My Right Honourable friend went on, "A Labour Party undoubtedly influenced and financed by the Marxist left, a Labour Party already propounding economic plans that would be deeply damaging to the free enterprise system, and with foreign and defence policies that would delight Moscow and dismay Washington." I'm very pleased to have the chance of quoting from my Right Honourable friend's most excellent speech. I also noticed that the Right Honourable friend had considerable strictures to say on housing. May I point out to him that the number of renovation grants paid in private sector housing has averaged 150,000 a year under this government, compared with less than 100,000 under Labour. In the public sector, the number of local authority renovations completed has run at 75,000 a year under this government, compared with 47,000 under Labour. And also, we have 1 million more houses and flats in the dwelling stock than we had under Labour. The fact is, his government couldn't hold a candle to the record of our government on housing and on many, many other aspects. He also gave us his views, about public expenditure. And I understand that not for him, the firm control of public expenditure referred to in the gracious speech. Although firm control of public expenditure is absolutely critical to confidence in any government. We know his universal remedy: more spending, more taxation, and more borrowing. And if we had more borrowing, we had more borrowing, the interest rates to which he referred would be infinitely higher, but he hasn't the wit to know it. Indeed, since the Right Honourable Gentleman became leader of his party, Labour have pledged to increase spending on transport and communications by £6 billion, on employment and training measures by £9 billion, on local government by £9 billion, on social security by £10 billion, and on housing and health by £17 billion. And only a fortnight ago, he promised to double the aid programme. The most reckless promises ever made. And as a former Labour Chief Secretary said, the task of the last Labour government was, and these are his words, rendered impossible by pledges foolishly made without any serious thought as to where the money would come from. You name it, he said, we were pledged to increase it. They're well on the way to doing the same. And following enormous increases, the consequences, Mr. Speaker, were massive cuts, bigger than anything before or since. Indeed, that inveterate diarist, Mrs. Barbara Castle, has recorded that to while away the time in a cabinet meeting, one of her... they hate being reminded of their reckless stewardship of the economy of Britain. And as Mrs. Castle said, one of her colleagues in a cabinet meeting passed her a rhyme which said, all things bright and beautiful, all projects great and small, all things wise and wonderful, Dennis Healy cuts them all. Healy cuts the old age pension, although he cuts by stealth, and when he looks for savings, Healy cuts the national health. And he did, 2 years in succession. Mr. Speaker, it is because we have kept firm control of public spending that the gracious speech can go on to talk about further reductions in the burden of income tax. You have to be firm, Mr. Speaker, on public spending to be fair to the taxpayer. I contrast the approach of the Right Honourable Member for Sparkbrook, who in recent months has described how he imagines Labour fantasies would be paid for, including what he calls some increase in tax revenues. Some increase. Labour's spending plans would require savage increases in taxation, not just on those earning £20,000 a year, whom the Right Honourable Gentleman dismisses so contemptuously as rich. It would mean more tax for the primary school head teacher earning £200 a week, who already pays £60 in taxes and contributions. It would mean more tax for the nurse earning £140 a week, who already pays £40 a week. It would mean more tax for the metal worker earning £185 a week, who already pays £52. Mr. Speaker, they say socialism was founded to help the working man to keep more of the fruits of his own labour. Today, socialists want to take more. It is we Conservatives who believe that people have a right to keep more of their own earnings, as the gracious speech makes very clear. Not only have they a right, Mr. Speaker, but that is the way to an efficient, competitive, and more prosperous economy. The gracious speech continues our reforming approach with a considerable programme of legislation. It provides for measures to promote employment, especially among young people, measures to extend enterprise and increase competition by more privatisation and deregulation, measures to ensure that the social services are effectively managed and soundly financed, measures to strengthen the accountability of local government, and measures to reinforce the powers of the police and the courts in relation to public order and to drugs. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
Would the Prime Minister tell the House why there's been a 40% increase in reported crime under this government? Why, over the last 6 years, has there been a 40% increase?
Speaker, I will come on to deal with public order later. Crime has risen in all Western industrial countries in all Western industrial countries and in other countries over the last years? And if he can answer that, he can answer the nature of evil. Mr. Speaker, that programme will be carried forward within a framework described in the gracious speech as firm monetary and fiscal policies designed to secure a continuing reduction in inflation. And that is the important thing, Mr. Speaker, a continuing reduction in inflation, something which the party opposite signally failed to do. Now, by contrast, Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman's policies would inevitably, or by design, lead to a return of rapid inflation, although I notice he calls it reflation. It's an insidious word, but it's a deliberate policy to put up prices faster all round to the housewife and to the businessman. And it's a deliberate policy to slash the value of savings to the pensioner and everyone who saves. And it doesn't stop there. Higher inflation followed by higher unemployment. That is the history of the last 20 years, so said the last Labour Prime Minister. Mr. Speaker, we totally and utterly reject a policy of reflation for those reasons. We want inflation down. The party opposite want it up. Mr. Speaker, as a result of our consistent and sound financial policies, this will be our fifth year of uninterrupted economic growth at an average of 3% a year. And this is the first time since the war that we've had such a long period of growth, coupled with both balance of payment surpluses, and low inflation. Honourable members opposite talk disparagingly of the performance of manufacturing industry, but last year, British industry exported more manufactured goods than ever before in our history. But they need to be congratulated, not criticised. How they hate it when manufacturing industry does well. How they hate success. Poverty, the sort of riots you get in socialist areas, that's what suits them. And you find Labour local authorities, and there you will find poverty of a greater and deeper sort than any elsewhere. Manufacturing investment was up by 14%, and manufacturing output was 4% up, the biggest last year, the biggest rise since 1973. Yes, the numbers employed in manufacturing are still falling. Indeed, they've been falling since the mid-90s.
Order. I'm sorry to interrupt the Prime Minister, but may I order? I say to the House that the Leader of the Opposition was given a fair hearing. The Prime Minister should equally have a fair hearing.
Mr. Speaker, I'm trying to get a fair hearing for the performance of management and workforce in manufacturing industry. The opposition does not want to hear it. Mr. Speaker, indeed, the numbers employed in manufacturing industry have been falling since the mid-1960s, and they've been falling in almost every Western industrialised economy. That is a consequence of changes in technology and of the fact that many goods are made more cheaply in the countries around the Pacific Basin and in Southeast Asia. But British industry has become more efficient. Manufacturing productivity has increased dramatically, and last year profitability, the foundation of future growth, was at its highest since 1973. This was achieved by the new realism of industry itself, management and workforce alike. It was not and could not be achieved by government and Whitehall. The duty of governments is to create the conditions in which enterprise can expand and flourish, and to help in educating and training a skilled workforce. Mr. Speaker, this government has done more to train young people than any other in history. That is the truth. And the Right Honourable Gentleman does not falsify it by bellowing from the front bench. This government has done more to train young people than any other in history. The millions the millionth trainee will enter the government's youth training scheme before Christmas. But for young people in general, the evidence suggests that wage rates set artificially high are destroying their chances of a job. The OECD itself commented in a recent report that minimum wages restrict employment openings and opportunities to upgrade skills, especially among the young. We agree, and we are therefore introducing legislation to reform the wages councils. This will enable employers to offer the wage rate which they can afford and which young people can accept. Mr. Speaker, the measures we have already taken have led to a rapid increase in the number of new jobs, 675,000 in the last 2 years, more than any other country in the European Community. Indeed, new jobs have been created in this country over the last 2 years at a faster rate than at any time since 1973. But then, of course, the working population has been rising even faster. Even so, the CBI still report that their members cannot find suitably qualified people for some of the jobs that are available. It is a matter of getting the training right, a task both for industry and education. Mr. Speaker, it is the wealth creators who are the job creators. All economic policies must be designed as a spur to the wealth creators, whether they be brilliant scientists, skilled tradesmen, talented designers, or shrewd managers who know the marketplace, or young people with the ideas and initiative to start up on their own. And those who set out to penalize wealth creators, whether by punitive taxation or too much red tape, are really penalizing those who are looking for jobs. Mr. Speaker, industry performs much better when it has to compete for customers, when it has to give a reasonable return to the shareholders who invest in its future. Take Jaguar. Profits are up 54% since privatization, and there are over 500 more jobs. Take Amersham International. Profits are up fivefold and over 200 more jobs. We have already transferred to the private sector 12 companies and 400,000 employees, the majority of whom have bought shares in their companies. That is real ownership by the public. That is why there'll be a further assault. When I come to the end of this section, I'll give way to the Honourable Gentleman. That is why there'll be a further assault this year in what used to be called the commanding heights of ownership by the state. Provision will be made to privatise the British Gas Corporation, and we hope British Airways will be transferred to the private sector. Individual share ownership has already doubled under this government, and we look forward to it doubling again. By the end of this Parliament, we shall have reduced the share of our industry in state hands by 40%. That is an excellent record, Mr. Speaker. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm very grateful to the Right Honourable, Lady. When the Right Honourable Lady refers to jobs, how can she justify the decline of the British steel industry, especially in Scotland? How can she justify the intention this week of British Steel to make men redundant in the tube industry in Lanarkshire at the same time as they're importing from Italy, a country which has drawn a cart, a horse and cart through the quota system, to introduce those imports from Italy and to make our steel workers unemployed is surely something that even the Prime Minister can't justify.
Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman and Honourable and Right Honourable Members opposite are well aware, there is overproduction of steel, and no amount of special pleading can keep open steel plants if there is no sale for the products. The Right Honourable Gentleman sitting just below him knows full well he couldn't keep open the Ebbw Vale steel plant. And he said at a meeting of his constituents when he said to them, if you dodge the truth, the difficulties and complications will be even worse in the future. This government has in fact allocated some £130 million to purchase part of the quota from private sector steel industry to keep Ravenscraig going. That was the kind of faith which this House showed in trying to keep steel making going in Scotland. But in the end it will depend upon how competitive we are and how much we can sell in cooperation with the European steel community. Mr. Speaker, it is only by continuing the economic policies which have already brought 4 years of sustained growth that we shall be able to pay for improved public services. And Mr. Speaker, they have improved under this government. In the National Health Service, we've not only increased provision, we've achieved greater efficiency. As a result, more patients are being treated under a Conservative National Health Service. Waiting lists have been cut and more hospitals have been built. In education, spending per pupil and pupil-teacher ratios are at their best ever levels. But the quality of education needs to be improved and must be improved. That is why my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Education and Science, is insisting on agreement to a new pay structure and conditions of service. Only then will he release the very substantial sums of money available to increase teachers' pay, some £1.25 billion, over the next 4 years. This session's education bill will provide for a national system of appraisal to enable all teachers to improve their performance and to help the better teachers get more promotion and more pay. Mr. Speaker, this session we shall introduce a bill, which I understand the Right Honourable Gentleman will not support, to implement the most fundamental review of Social Security for 40 years. The bill will help to create a modern, effective Social Security system which future generations can afford. A Social Security system which will direct resources to those most in need, which will be based on sound finance and not hollow promises, and which will strengthen incentives to work so that no one is worse off by taking a job. There are too many cases, Mr. Speaker, even at a time of high unemployment, of jobs remaining unfilled because potential applicants are better off not working. Mr. Speaker, last session saw the successful passage of the bill to abolish the GLC and the Metropolitan County Councils. The unscrupulous use of ratepayers' money by those councils to mount massive scare campaigns reinforced the case for their abolition. It also demonstrated clearly that we can no longer take for granted in some Labour councils the conventions of responsible public service which used to inspire councillors of all parties. We're therefore introducing this session a bill along the lines proposed by the independent Widdecombe Committee to ban the use of ratepayers' money to finance political propaganda. The bill will also lay a statutory duty on all rating authorities to make their rate by April every year. These measures will be an important check on abuses by some local authorities. We shall also be publishing our proposals for a major reform of the rating system. We can no longer tolerate a system in which the burden of local taxation is so unfairly distributed, nor a system which permits extravagant local authorities to fleece the business ratepayer to finance excessive levels of spending. There is no surer way of driving jobs away from some of our inner cities. Mr. Speaker, the Home Office will be having its customary busy parliamentary session. In addition to legislation on public order, to which I shall refer shortly, they will be introducing three major bills. First, my right honourable friend will be introducing shops legislation in line with the main recommendations of the old committee. I recognise the difficulty which this measure will cause to some of my honourable friends. Indeed, many people, both customers and shopkeepers, will wish to preserve the traditional Sunday and will not take advantage of a change in the law. But I believe it is absolutely right to give people the choice. The present state of the law is indefensible. Second, my right honourable friend will also be introducing... Second, my right honourable friend will also be introducing the first reform for 109 years of the law on experiments on living animals. I believe this will be widely welcomed throughout the House and outside, and I hope it will secure a speedy passage. Third, we shall be taking further action against drug offenders. Following the excellent report of the Select Committee on Home Affairs last session, we shall be introducing a bill to provide wide new powers for tracing and confiscating the proceeds of drug trafficking. And I believe this measure too will be supported throughout the House. The war against the drugs trade is one which all decent people will expect us to unite. Before most of this legislation is introduced, the historic meeting between President Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev, due 2 weeks from now, will have taken place. Mr. Speaker, both leaders have accepted the aim of reducing nuclear weapons. The United States has long had detailed proposals on the table for deep, balanced, and verifiable reductions. Now they have responded promptly to the recent Soviet counterproposals and offered to build upon the positive elements in them. The test of Soviet intentions will be Mr. Gorbachev's willingness to engage in real negotiations. President Reagan has undertaken that the United States Strategic Defense Initiative research program will remain clearly within the bounds of the ABM Treaty. I hope that the Soviet Union's own very extensive research program will be similarly contained. Indeed, I believe that a reaffirmation and strengthening of the ABM Treaty would be a positive and commendable outcome of the summit. I would hope, too, that the President and Mr. Gorbachev will commit themselves to make progress in other arms control negotiations. Above all, the negotiations on chemical weapons and on mutually balanced force reductions in Europe, which for more than 10 years have made little progress. It has been NATO's strength and steadfastness which have brought us to the point where we can hope for real reductions in nuclear armaments on both sides. When the defense ministers of the 16 NATO countries met last week, their communique said, "We declare that the President goes to Geneva with the full support and solidarity of the alliance." We on this side of the House are united in offering this support. Mr. Speaker, during the debate on the address last year, I said that upholding the rule of law was the crucial issue facing this country. The disturbances we have seen in a few of Britain's inner cities have made that all the more apparent. Indeed, it is the vast majority of people living there, the old, the families with young children, the small businessmen, who have most to lose from a breakdown of law and order. It is they, not the rioters, who have lost their homes, their shops, and most of all, their peace of mind. Of course, there are very severe social problems in inner city areas, problems of family breakdown, of racial tension, of drug abuse, of youth unemployment, of bad housing. Insofar as money can help, those problems are taken into account in public expenditure, including the urban programme on which £1,900 million has been spent since 1979. Considerable sums had already been spent in the areas affected by riots. But the kind of violence which took place on the streets of Brixton, Handsworth and Tottenham recently cannot and will not be eradicated by money. The solution must ultimately lie in a strengthening of our traditional sources of discipline and authority. The family, the church, the school, responsible community and civic leadership, and support for the police. Yeah. This government had made it clear that the police will have the resources they need in the fight against crime. When this session's public order bill has become law, they will also have more powers to prevent and deal with violence and disorder. But those measures alone are not enough. If the rest of us fail to support the police, if we undermine by words or deeds the rule of law, the fight against lawlessness would be jeopardized. Mr. Speaker, it is not good enough for the party opposite to stand aside and tolerate Labour local authorities which harass and obstruct the police. And it is not good enough for the party opposite to claim they support the police while their conference is passing anti-police motions and cheering to the echo descriptions of the police as the enemy. And it is not good enough for the Right Honourable Gentleman to condemn the words of the leader of Haringey Council against the police while continuing to endorse him as a Labour candidate for election. The party leadership which stands by while sections of their party undermine the police cannot be taken seriously when they talk of support for the law. Mr. Speaker, either they stand up for the law or they do not. They cannot have it both ways. This government rests firmly on respect for the rule of law, and it is on that fundamental basis that I commend to the House the forward-looking programme set out in the gracious speech.